Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Dr. Foss is joined by Dr. Paul Jubinski. Dr. Jubinski is Assistant Professor of Pediatrics in Hematology Oncology at Yale School of Medicine. Here's Francine Foss.
Can we start off by having you let our audience know what is a pediatric oncologist and what is your training?
Yeah, so a pediatric oncologist is somebody who starts off with full pediatric training, much as the things that you would see at your pediatrician's office, and then gets a little bit more specialty training. And so after finishing our pediatric in the hospital, as a member, like internship and residency, we go on to do a fellowship, which is a minimum of 3 years, and some people expanded that a little bit longer, where we get clinical training and then research training in the areas of oncology. And oncology, as you know, is patients with cancer.
Can you define pediatrics? I mean, many of us think about little kids, but I know pediatrics can go up into the early 20s. Can you define the age of your population?
That's exactly right. I mean, typically a lot of people will think about pediatrics once they get to be 18. They sort of transition over. People think they don't want to be in the office with little kids. Pediatric oncology is probably a little bit different, and some of the other pediatric fields are changing that way, because what happens is that within oncology, there's actually a different subsets of tumors that exist in a pediatric population than exist in an adult population. And what happens is that boundary between adult and pediatrics for some of these tumors, where they're becoming 20, 21, 22, and 23, they end up having a tumor that's more common in somebody who may be 5 or 6. And the adult people who see, in all honesty, more patients, they just don't have the experience in those areas where there's an overlap. And so we will treat people. We've treated people certainly up to the age of 27. And we've also, which is a little bit different than what you think about pediatrics, typically if somebody comes in on pediatric oncology and they get diagnosed and they may not get cured really fast, or they may have a relapse, we tend not to overly switch those over to the adult population, because there's such a bond in between. And that we do, you know, because of the nature of pediatrics, where we do a lot of things, as we make big efforts and we have a little bit more time to take care of people when they're sort of outside the standard group.
And it sounds like things are probably more fun in your clinic anyway, because you've got the toys and the audiovisual things
to
play with.
That's exactly right. And I think it makes a difference no matter what your age group is I could tell you that adults would probably be happy having some kids in the clinic playing and running around than, you know, other people where they're, you know, as I said, adults, we don't always have a good time when we're doing stuff. And I think having kids around make us think about other problems. So to some degree, I think even though people like age differences, I think for adults, they probably wouldn't mind having another oncology kid, because oncology people really do associate with each other very strongly, no matter what the age group is.
Can you talk a little bit about pediatric cancers? Can you tell us how common is cancer in the pediatric population?
Well, compared to the adults, we're talking about really small change. I mean, we don't think of it that way because we do different things. But in terms of total numbers in the country, there may only be about 12,000 cases a year of all the oncology problems. And if you think about 50 states and everything else, you realize there's, you know, hundreds of cases, depending on the size of a state, of new oncology patients. And when you think of adults and you think of lung cancer, or breast cancer, when there's 50 or 60,000 or around 50,000 of those, we're way down on the spectrum. But obviously, you know, from our perspective, based on the age group and because of the impact and because it's sort of at somebody's at beginning of their life, that we obviously think it's extremely important, even though the numbers aren't where everybody else's are.
Can you talk about what the most common pediatric cancers are?
Yeah, so the most common pediatric cancer is probably what most people usually see is leukemia. And leukemia is a cancer of the blood cells, and it's a little, as people know, is it's a little bit different than the solid tumors that adults usually get, where the tumor is everywhere. And so that's the most common. And there's two major types, which is lymphoblastic, which is from a lymphocyte, and then other ones that are myeloid cells. And I don't want to get technical. And altogether, those are a little over 40%. And then after that, the next most common is brain tumors, which is around 25%. And then we have all the other tumors, which is way more probably that we have more populations of tumors than the adults have. They have more numbers, but we have more kinds. And so then we have a smattering where there's 5 or 6%, like neuroblastomas, Wilms tumors, bone tumors are all in that percentages. And then you get down to this other oddball population where there's, you know, 20 or 30 cases that were ever been reported, and they exist in the pediatric age group. And, you know, one of the things and one of the challenges and one of the things most of us who like in the field is that even though you may not have a lot of cases, it gives you an opportunity to learn about new things. And because our volume, you know, the advantage of not having the volume is that we can spend a little bit more time with patients, because I know my adult colleagues, and they work extremely hard. But we work hard in a different way, and they work harder in volume, and we work harder in making sure that when it's an unusual disease that we have to spend more time making sure that we have everything covered and we know how to take care of these kids. So we do some of it. We have to call colleagues or actually figure out, is this the absolute best therapy? Because if there's only a few kids, what might have changed? You know, if the last case was 5 years ago, you try to put it together. So those are some of the differences between the way, you know, adult and pediatrics are, at least on how we take care of patients.
So you're alluding to the pediatric oncology group and kind of national groups that look at how pediatric cancers are being treated and establish some standards for them?
That's right. I mean, the basic stuff is that whenever somebody comes in, for the common stuff, we basically know how to do it. For the less common, we look through the pediatric oncology group, which is essentially all the hospitals in the country, plus Canada, plus most of Australia and a bunch of other countries, where we try in pediatrics, because of the less number of patients, that we really value each patient and trying to learn what we can, not so much of an experiment, but to collect the data and say, can we utilize how people are treated to try to make things better? We can't afford to get the field moving by not collecting data on essentially every patient that comes in.
So the pediatricians are much better at doing that than the adult oncologists in terms of getting patients on national clinical trials.
That's right. And I mean, it's multifactorial. A lot of it is because we know if we don't do it, we're never going to get anywhere. The other part of it is that, you know, the adults, because of their volume and because it's set up, is most of pediatrics, with rare exceptions, and that they're getting rarer and rarer, that things are in academic medical centers. There's not like you can open up a practice in, you know, middle of Connecticut away from a hospital and say, I want to see a lot of patients, where the adults have enough patients to do it. And because of that, we're academic, and there's a huge academic function that is sort of brainwashed. I don't want to call it brainwashed, but when you go through pediatric training, it's sort of like, this is what you're expected. You got to do something. You can see patients, but they really emphasize some kind of way of making improvement in the world, whether it's clinical studies or a little bit more basic, or, you know, and some of it isn't even always collecting data, but trying to make things better for patients and improving services. So if you're not doing actual research, there's a big emphasis saying is make where you are, what you're doing, a better thing. And that's supported.
So most of the patients that are seen here at Smilow Cancer Center in pediatrics are referred in. Presumably they're diagnosed by a community pediatrician.
Well, what happens, this is another difference between adults and pediatrics. What happens is that people come with different problems, and depending on the severity, they typically sometimes will get seen into clinic if we have an idea of how ill they are, or from the pediatrician's office they call in, or if they're a little bit more ill, they come into the emergency room. The thing that's a lot more different is that it's only on extremely rare occasion that when they come to see me or any of my colleagues as an oncologist, do they have a diagnosis. And because there's, and I think rightly so, what happens is a lot of people don't have a lot of experience. And when you start off in the beginning, it's devastating. I think the adults, somebody says, you know, you go to your internist and they say, well, I feel a mass in your breast or something. You may have breast cancer or somebody knows it. In the pediatric population, those families, most of them don't know anybody who has cancer. I mean, you know, you go to a school, there may be one or two kids and they're not in the right grade and they don't know it. And so they basically come in thinking that their kid never has a problem, never is going to get cancer. They never know anyone with cancer. And because of that, the pediatricians don't really know how to approach, you know, you got to ease them into it. You can't just say, I looked at the blood smear, it looks terrible, you know, we got a big problem, we got to put a line in and it'll fix you. You sort of understand where they're coming from. You have to understand their feelings and their knowledge and their whole base, and then try to really tailor it, because the families are critically important. If they have an issue, whether, you know, not even educationally, but if they have a major, you know, breakdown from the diagnosis, which is because it's a devastating diagnosis, it really impacts on the kid coming into the hospital, the kid thinking that they're the cause of why mommy's crying, and it makes the dynamics a little bit more difficult. And certainly the other part of it is that on occasion somebody thinks they know what the diagnosis is, and even us, we're extremely careful. We say, here's the possibilities, but we do pathology and we try to define it the best we can. But even then we say is sometimes it takes other people and other places to help us look at it, because once you tell somebody it's X, if you got to go back and say it's Y, it's really, really, really hard. It takes them like months to get over it, because they just can't believe that medicine still has some difficulty in making diagnoses, and it's a tough thing. So we take that into account and try to be very careful.
It sounds to me like you really need a multidisciplinary approach to this. Can you tell us in your clinic at the Smilow Cancer Center what different components are available to help families with this issue?
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, I got to say, we as physicians do the best we can. But what I would say is that as much as I think our families love us or will get to like us in the long term, I think that they feel, for whatever reason, more comfortable. And some of it's because they don't want to, like they say, well, we don't want to waste your time. But when they talk to like the nursing staff, who is massively important for our education and support, they are huge, just like it is anywhere else, but it's more important in pediatrics because moms who typically bring the kids in more often can connect it with them. But then we have all the other people. And so one thing is to get the educational part down. But the other part that's critically important, and then the services. So we'll go to social work. And there's so many things that families need to worry about, like how do you get this taken care of? You know, can is there a way to like divvy up the work in the household? What do we do about schools? We got people for the schools, getting resources because people are out of work, and you know, even people who have great insurance never have coverage for a lot of things that we need to do, because some things that we do, I mean, there's things that are absolutely positively medical that have to get done, and then there's things that make people do better. It means like they do better in school, they adapt better, they're able to still function, and the family's intact, and those things don't get covered by insurance companies. They don't care as they don't care as much, and those things are things that are critically important and are supported by the Cancer Center and some of the other money we have. But the other part that I want before we move on is that we have people who are like the child life people, and what they do is they create an environment where kids play, where the clinic ends up being a fun place and not a scary place, and people like to come in and they socialize, and kids who are like themselves socialize, and they all do that, and everybody has their part, and they all do it independently. And so people end up, they don't like going into the hospital for admissions as much, but going into clinic, the kids by and large like to come in, and even the older kids where you say, you know, they want to go out and do their own thing, they are comfortable. And that's where the comprehensive approach takes out the stress and makes it easier, where as physicians, you don't, what we sometimes call as firefighting, where an issue comes up where it doesn't have anything always to do with us, and you know, something doesn't go totally smoothly or the family's unhappy, we have all these other people to help.
Okay, that's really very extensive. And I'd like to talk a little bit about actually how you tell a child that they have cancer, but I think we actually will have to break for a medical minute before we can get into that. I'm sure that's going to be a lengthy discussion. This is Dr. Foss, and we're taking a brief break for a medical minute.
There are over 12 million cancer survivors in the United States right now, and the numbers keep growing. Completing treatment for cancer is a very exciting milestone, but cancer and its treatment can be a life-changing experience. The return to normal activities and relationships may be difficult, and cancer survivors face other long-term side effects of cancer, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, and an increased risk of second cancers. Resources for cancer survivors are available at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the one at Yale Cancer Center, to keep cancer survivors well and focused on healthy living. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. And we're here today discussing pediatric oncology. So, Paul, you talked a lot about the multidisciplinary approach that's available at the Smilow Cancer Center. Can you backtrack and address that really important question, which is, how do you actually go about telling a child that he or she has cancer? What do you tell them?
So, as we talked about in a lot of things in pediatrics, everything is age-dependent. And what I talk about, what I'm going to be talking about, is mostly the way I do it. Obviously, there's a little bit of variation between other people. But what the approach is that we like to get them, depending on where they are in a comfortable circumstance, we bring in other people who are going to be involved in their care. And so typically, people will get followed by a nurse most of the time in clinic and a lot of the time inpatient. If we know what nurse is likely going to be assigned to them, we bring them in to try to get the group together, because there's a big bonding process in the beginning. But the way I usually start is I usually already, I go back and do a history and all that, but I mean, I already know, based from other people's histories, sort of what been going on with the patient. And I sort of say, how have you been feeling, and are you feeling good? And you get an idea of where they are. And if they come in, I mean, some people come in really healthy. Most people who come in, and certainly through the emergency room, come in with a lot more symptoms, which we can talk about more later. But depending on what it is, I say, do you know why you're in the hospital? And I say, well, hospitals are to make us better. And I said, that's right. I said, you're in here because you have some things that are going on with you that don't make you feel very well. And why you're here is we're here to make you better. And I said, and a lot of the time you go to the doctor, we can get you better in a couple of days. I said, for the problems that we think may be going on with you, it's not going to be a couple of days. Unfortunately, it may end up being years, but I said, that's what we expect, and that's what we do it. And so we introduced the idea that it's a problem. You don't start off with a cancer as a problem. It's just that things aren't right, and then you want to make it better. And then you sort of evolve over, and you sort of say, well, it's not like a pneumonia. It's these things that go longer. And you sort of say, well, what, they say, well, what is it? And I mean, obviously the older kids know what cancer are, but with the younger ones, you just say in the analogy I use for a lot of things is I use gardens and weeds. And I say, we have good things that grow in the soil, and if it's for bone marrow, and then we have things that don't want to grow there. And I said, sometimes your yard overgrows, and there are certain parts of your body which is just not behaving themselves, just like we don't behave all the time. Other parts of your body don't behave. And it's like when weeds in the garden, if we let those get too big, they affect the rest of the garden, and we need to get those things to go away so your good tomato plants are happy. And that's sort of the general stuff on the lower level people, just to get them in.
Do you use the word cancer?
We use what we in the beginning. I don't at the right off the top use the word cancer. Once they know where I'm doing with the analogies, then what I say is, and I said, so I'm telling you sort of what's going on with it, but now what we need to do is just so you know, most things that have problems, like you have an ear infection, we call it an ear infection, but everything that we deal with here has a name. And the name that you have for this is, if it ends up being like a bone tumor, I said, it's called a Ewing sarcoma. And a Ewing sarcoma is a lot of these things that we call cells that make up your body, and they're bad. And what they make up is a very large group of medical problems that people either call our malignancies, which they may not know what it means, or a cancer. And then I just stop. I mean, there are on occasion a few families who don't want to use the term cancer, but typically we don't like to encourage that, because it's like any other terminology. The kids know that if they're on a floor and everybody, you can't hide it. And it's better just to be honest, because I think if you, we try not to go unless people force our hand, because we can't predict everybody from the beginning on how they're going to do. But we go in with the impression is that there's always something to offer, and that we work really hard to get rid of the bad cells. And if, you know, in the beginning, if they don't ask me, are you absolutely going to get rid of it, I don't usually bring that up. When things go on a little bit more and we start to go into a little bit more of the details, we sort of bring up that sometimes things don't work one way and that we have to switch gears. But it's usually on a lot of these really difficult questions, we wait for them to have an understanding, and kids typically will ask what they want to ask, and there's things they don't want to hear. There's things they just say, they'll go, even a 15-year-old will go to me and say, you know what, I'm tired. My mom loves me. She's going to take care of me because I can't understand all this. And they defer. And so some people want to be in the room and some people don't. But we typically let them decide what they want to know, because our feeling is if they aren't told, I think it sets up credibility issues.
So in the research area, we have the age of assent. So when a child is old enough to make their own decisions. So how does that play into your practice in pediatric oncology? When do you feel that a child is old enough to say what you just said, which is, I don't want to hear any more of this?
Oh, I think at any age they do it. I mean, whatever age they do it is, you know, what you got to realize is that it's like everybody, especially in the beginning, we all have our ups and downs. And so there's going to be days where, you know, there's probably days I go to work where I don't want to talk to anybody either, you know, and so they do the same thing. And so what you got to do is that when they want to pull back, you let them pull back. You don't want to disengage somebody who's old enough to really comprehend their care and get involved in their practice and in the treatment, because it's totally essential that they're on board and they understand and they know what you're doing, because it's scary enough coming in and getting therapy, but, you know, they're old enough to know the long term. And, you know, we feel that because the outcome is so good in everyone, we probably don't discourage non-treatment.
Can you go back and tell us a little bit about some of these common pediatric cancers? Are the kids symptomatic when they come in, and what do we actually do to treat them? I think you said leukemia was the first most common, and brain tumors were the second most common.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, what happens with most pediatrics is not that much different than what happens in adults. Something shows up. You know, it could be big, it could be small. You know, the boy or the girl may be a little bit tired, or they may have an ache or a pain. So in leukemia, it typically ends up having things to do with the blood counts, because leukemia outgrows it. But they typically have anemia, which means they get tired easily. Sometimes the blood cells that are involved in keeping you from getting bruises, the platelets, they end up bruising a little bit easier, or they get low-grade fevers, or because of leukemia is inside the bone marrow, they get aches and pains. And what happens is everybody gets these problems. And so they go on, and because a lot of cancers aren't like up and down in one day, it's usually a gradation of a process. There's usually several weeks where things aren't just right, but they're not enough to put a finger on. They go to a pediatrician. Pediatrician looks like, you know, they got the virus. And, you know, mom comes and says, well, something's just not right, but it's just not like the other viruses. And so they usually go for quite a while until, like, often somebody else looks at them and says, oh my God, your kid's pale. Like, you need to do something, or because it's that gradation. And then they come in and get blood work done, and then which shows abnormalities that confirm it. For a lot of the other tumors, it's another physical sign. So for bone tumors, it's typically pain and occasionally swelling. What usually happens in them is they get kicked, because everybody gets kicked, and it takes 6 weeks. So the average time for a bone tumor after onset of symptoms is about 2 months of presentation of rather severe bone pain that's localized and sometimes with swelling, because most people, and even common pediatricians, because they only see one or two maybe diagnoses in their lifetime, they just don't think oncology. And so a long period goes by, and then after a while people say, well, it's been like 3 months or whatever it is with a problem. Don't you think that's a little bit weird? And then everybody sort of gets the radar going up, and all of a sudden it goes from nothing to all of a sudden everything gets done in a short period of time. But other things present with masses, so liver tumors, some lymphomas with the nodes that we think of people who have lymph nodes, and people always worry about lymphomas and Hodgkin's disease, and then belly masses. But usually some of it is just feeling not so good, weight loss, not eating, moping. Sometimes if it's a brain tumor, you'll see nerve findings, your eyes don't work right. Some of the kids, as much as I don't like to say this because it's sort of not a common thing, I've had a couple of patients where they were absolute A students. They were A students their entire life. They got into eighth grade. They went from A to B. It took a year. And then they went from B to C, and they were seen by pediatricians. Nothing showed up on exam. And they said, well, you know, the kid's having a hard time. He doesn't feel good. It's a new school. And some of those kids end up having something bad. So, I mean, the range, and most of that is extremely uncommon. And for brain tumors, it's extremely uncommon. But it just goes to tell you the difficulty with diagnosing some tumors in some people and why it's hard. We have the luxury. And so if you ever want to know why we like pediatric oncology, is one of the luxuries we have is when somebody comes into us, is we assume they have bad stuff until we prove otherwise. And so we do a lot of tests when they come in to say, you know what, now we can say you're clear, because even then we have to sometimes bring people back if tests aren't definitive.
Do you sometimes see kids who turn out not to have cancer?
Yeah, I mean, there's some things that you think with experience that you're gonna get a good idea, or based on symptoms. And so things that can look like leukemia can sometimes be things that are extremely bad infections. So infections can do a lot of things to your body. We know people who have EBV infections, mono, where people get big nodes, and some of those end up being bad lymphomas, and some of those get big and go small, or they're solitary, or there's things that we call adenitises, which are bacterial infections. And so there's a whole series of things. People get distensions and everything else. And, you know, a lot of times, based on clinical experience, we do get an idea from feel, but no one can predict the future. And so there's things that look bad, or when there's recovering marrows, we get things that look like blasts or other things. And you know what? They go away. And, you know, in fact, there are some tumors that we know do go away. And, you know, one of them is neuroblastoma, where it can be a malignant tumor in the beginning, and with age, with or without treatment, it can turn itself back into normal tissue. And so there's a lot of things where the cut and dryness that we always think about malignancies are not as clear as what you would always expect.
Do you anticipate, for most of your patients with pediatric cancers, do you anticipate curing them, or is that your intent when you begin the treatment?
Our intent for essentially, when the numbers are low enough, you can never know for a fact if there's 10 cases, but we believe that everybody is potentially curable and that everybody deserves a chance of at least the optimal therapy. After that, with difficult cases, it gets a little bit more tricky depending on symptoms. You know, treatment that we decide on difficult cases is obviously done with the family's wishes as 100% as the guide, but treatment is also, besides guided by what we know and what we don't know, is based on with difficult cases, we tend not to do things that make people uncomfortable. And with the advent of more targeted therapies and antibody therapies and small molecule inhibitors, we can do things that allow people to almost function like they're not getting any chemotherapy on oral agents, which hopefully will have an effect. But what you got to realize is that when, and this is another difference between us and the adults, when you're 85 and you live another 6 months, people say, you know, what does that mean? I've had people where I've, for whatever reason, have been able to extend them where we knew it was a very bad prognosis, where you thought they might live a year, and you live to get them to 3 years. And when these kids go to Disney World and the family pulls together and they do their activities, you know, it may be that, you know, the outcome is bad, but that is worth so much stuff that you can't believe that has anything to do with cure or not cure, right? Which shows up in the papers. It's just part of being people. And that's what we want to do.
So you would say overall that there's hope for patients with pediatric cancers?
We think that the cure rate is extremely high. The cure rate for all cancers is up to 75%. There's difficult things, but there's always new things in the pipeline. We work hard. We try to recombine, changing and doing things will often, not always, but give you a surprise. And so with a kid, we always, by and large, think it's worth it.
Dr. Paul Jubinski is Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Hematology Oncology at Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.